We were contemplating last time, if you remember, the trials before first Annas and then Caiaphas, before it was going to be ratified by the full Sanhedrin council, and then the Lord was going to be taken to Pontius Pilate and then to Herod. We suggested towards the end of the class last time that this basically was all prearranged. It was a collusion between the religious authorities with Pontius Pilate to get the matter over done with quickly, and we suggested that perhaps Pontius Pilate had been bribed to be there so early in the morning to pass judgment upon the Lord. We also commented as to why the chief priests had brought many false witnesses against the Lord, but none could agree. And the person who was absent in all the comments and all the accusations which were going on was Judas Iscariot. He'd been the one who had been instrumental in bringing the Lord into this judgment, so that he betrayed him and he caused the authorities to lead him to Annas and then to Pontius Pilate. But all through the Inquisition and the questioning, there's no comment at all regarding Judas Iscariot. And we suggested last time there must be a reason for that, and we will look at that in a few moments' time. So we're going to pick up where we left off with the Lord before Caiaphas. He'd already been questioned by Annas. He was now in the other side of the palace of the high priest, and it was Caiaphas, which we suggested with a few of the members of the Sanhedrin, who were talking to the Lord and bringing all these false witnesses. When we come to Matthew's Gospel and Matthew chapter 26, we'll just pick up the narrative from the fact in Matthew chapter 26 that verse 60, though they brought many false witnesses, they found none that could agree, and at last came to false witnesses and said, "This fellow said," verse 61 of Matthew 26, "I'm able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. Now, when you look at Mark's account in Mark chapter 15, you'll notice that Mark chapter 14, you'll notice that Mark adds a few extra words to what they were actually accusing the Lord of. It's in verse 58 of Mark chapter 14. When the false witnesses said, "We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands." But the comment says, "Neither so did their witness agree together." Now the actual record of that accusation is from John's Gospel in chapter 2. And as far as John's record is concerned, you will notice in verse 19 of John chapter 2 what the Lord actually said. He said, "Destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up." John makes the comment in verse 22, he spake of the temple of the body. But you'll notice how, like Chinese whisper, from what the Lord had actually said here, it had got distorted, so much so that the witnesses couldn't even agree together as to what he'd actually seen. And so they had to pass on. That wasn't going to be sufficient for them to be able to accuse and condemn the Lord. And so we come back to Matthew's record in Matthew 26, and we come back to verse 63. And now we have the high priest himself, and I would suggest it is Caiaphas. And we read there that after the accusation about the temple of God, Jesus held his peace. And the high priest answered and said unto him, "I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God." And that was going to be the accusation which the Lord acknowledged and agreed to, and it was on that basis they were going to condemn him to death. Now all the time up to this point, both before Caiaphas and before these witnesses who had come, the Lord didn't say anything. You'll notice at the beginning of verse 63, he held his peace. It was not necessary, him as the one who was being accused, to answer. He didn't have to make any comment. And yet he chose to do so here now. And it's interesting to reflect why he didn't challenge the other accusations, which were undoubtedly false. And so why does he now make some comment where he could have remained silent? I would suggest it's something which we find in verse 63, which perhaps we don't quite get in the authorized version, when Ananias says, "I adjure thee by the living God, tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God." I've brought along the New International Version, purely so that we can get an understanding of what this phrase, "I adjure thee by," actually is referring to. In verse 63, the New International Version puts it this way. The high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." So under oath, the high priest asked him to acknowledge whether or not he was the Christ, the Son of God. And I believe the Lord had to answer because of something which was written in the Jewish law. Can we go back to the book of Leviticus in chapter 5? Remember, the Lord had already said not one jot or tittle of the law would fail. And he was not come to destroy the law, but to fulfill it. And so when the high priest charged him under oath to acknowledge whether he was the Christ, the Son of the living God, or not, there seems to be a law in Leviticus chapter 5 and verse 1, which makes it clear that the Lord had to answer. Look at verse 1. If a soul sin, and hear the voice of swearing, and is a witness, whether he has seen it or known of it, if he do not utter it, then he shall bear his iniquity. Again, I can read it from the NIV to perhaps put it in a clearer way. If a person sins because he does not speak up when he hears a public charge to testify regarding something he has seen or learned about, he will be held responsible. And so the very fact that under oath the high priest was accusing him of to acknowledge whether or not he had claimed to be the Christ, the Son of the living God, or whether he was the Christ, the Son of the living God. And because he had under oath made a public charge, if the Lord didn't speak out, he would be held responsible according to law. Now it's all right and easy for us in hindsight for us to see what attack they were putting upon the Lord at this moment and how devious they were in their accusation of him. What we've got to ponder is, how did they know? How did they know, first of all, about him being the Christ, the Son of God? And more particularly, how could they get him to admit it for himself? Now, whether or not they knew the law of Leviticus 5, I would suggest the Lord did. And it's more likely that some of theirs did, because they were great students of the law. What they couldn't be sure of is to what the Lord would respond, if at all. And so what were they going to do then? I would suggest this is where they expected Judas to come in. I believe it was this charge which Judas had agreed with them was the means by which they could condemn the Lord. Now, there is a bit of speculation in this, but I think it's speculation based upon some good inferences we have in the scriptures. Can we go to Luke chapter 22? Now, we saw this earlier on in the studies when Judas had gone to the chief priests and sought how he might betray the Lord Jesus. Let's just read it for a moment. Verse 3 of Luke 22. Then entered Satan into Judas, surnamed Iscariot, being of the number of the 12. And he went his way and communed with the chief priests and captains, how he might betray him unto them. And they were glad and covenanted to give him money, and he promised and sought opportunity to betray him unto them in the absence of the multitude. Now, they obviously knew who the Lord was. They would know his whereabouts. They didn't want someone to point him out to them. They were fully aware as to who he was. They'd been seeking to kill him for nearly 3.5 years. And so there must have been something far more in what Judas was proposing to do for them than just saying, well, that's Jesus, take him and try him. And particularly when we have the phrase in verse 5, that when Judas had communed with them, they were glad. So there must have been something that Judas had got, which he believed would cause the Lord to be condemned before them, in order that they might kill him. And that was the sense of what we've got in verse 2. The chief priests and scribes sought how they might kill him. And so it would seem that it was Judas who was very aware of a particular matter which the Lord had obviously acknowledged, and at the time when the Apostle Peter had said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God, the Lord had said, don't tell anybody. Don't publicly proclaim that. And yet Judas knew that this was possibly the most important charge which they could accuse the Lord of, and to see what would happen. And I believe it was going to be at this point that if the Lord had held his peace, that Judas would have said something. But he doesn't. Because when we come back to Matthew chapter 26, I would suggest that the very response of the high priest in verse 65, after the Lord had acknowledged, yes, he was the Christ, the Son of the living God, and we'll come back to verse 64 in a moment. Then the high priest rent his clothes, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? And I would suggest that the high priest expected Judas to endorse what the Lord had been accused of, but he doesn't. The Lord acknowledges it himself, but there's no comment from any witnesses who were to support this accusation. And I believe that Judas, for whatever reason, decided not to testify. Now again, when we just go on in the narrative a moment and come to Matthew 27, what happened before Caiaphas first led him to the council? The council authorized that he should be condemned to death. And as they took him away to Pontius Pilate in verse 2, we then have this incident when Judas in verse 3, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself and brought again the 30 pieces of silver. If Judas had seen that he was condemned, he must have been there. At this moment in time, Pontius Pilate had not interviewed the Lord. So the actual pronouncement by Pontius Pilate, away with him, crucify him, do what you want with him, had not yet taken place. This was purely the Sanhedrin council who had confirmed what the Caiaphas, the high priest, had desired, that the Lord should be condemned to death. And Judas had seen that. And it was when he saw that he was condemned, he repented himself and brought again the 30 pieces of silver. So why did Judas, however genuine or otherwise it is, and we discussed it when we looked at Judas, and we didn't hear, but did Graham Whettall do it? He did a character study of Judas on Tuesday. I don't know if he went into this particular aspect of it. But it's interesting as to why Judas probably had a change of mind. The particular thing which we've got to sort of weigh up is, If he'd received the 30 pieces of silver and had done his job, why was he still around? If you're going to be a grass, if you're going to, you know, give somebody up to the authorities and give them information which could condemn him, you're not going to be around to see if it all works out. You've had your money, and therefore you've done your job. You don't want to be around in case you taint you with anything. But Judas was around. He obviously witnessed the things which the Lord endured before Annas and Caiaphas, and even when the Sanhedrin council met. And I would suggest that he'd been brought there because of the deal which he'd agreed with them, because he was going to level this charge of blasphemy against the Lord, that he was the Christ, the Son of the living God. But he doesn't. But because the Lord had acknowledged it himself, Judas was not called upon. There was no need for Judas. And therefore the high priest said, we don't need any witnesses. So if you, Judas, are not going to say anything, we don't need you to say anything, because the Lord had condemned himself out of his own mouth, so they thought. Let's just go back to 64 of Matthew 26 for a moment. Art thou the Christ, the Son of God? And the Lord answers, thou hast said. And he's quite emphatic. He was saying, yes, I am. And not only that, I say unto you, hereafter you shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. Now it's interesting, first and foremost, in the context of what we've got in verse 61, concerning the temple of God, that the confirmation from the Old Testament scriptures that God would be his father, of course, is in 2 Samuel 7. I will be his father and he shall be my son. And 2 Samuel 7, as we all know, came into the context of David wanting to build a temple for God. And God says, look, it's not for you to build this temple, you're a man of blood. But when thy days are fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with his fathers, and we can all recite the Davidic covenant. So the very fact of David wanting to build a temple for God, it's ironic here that they've been accusing him of destroying this temple and building it again in 3 days. And he says, yes, on the basis of 2 Samuel 7, I confirm that I am the Son of the living God. But not only that, I'm also the one mentioned in Psalm 110. And not only that, I'm also the one mentioned in Daniel chapter 7. And Psalm 110, as we know, is the Melchizedek Psalm. If we can just go back there for a moment. Now, the Lord didn't have to volunteer this. He could have just confirmed, he could have said nothing as we've said, or he could have just confirmed, yes, he was the Messiah. But he went further than that and said, I am the one who shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power. So verse 1 of Psalm 110, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou on my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool. Verse 4, the Lord hath sworn and will not repent, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Remember to whom the Lord was responding. Caiaphas, the high priest of Israel at that time. And he says, Caiaphas, not only am I the Son of God, the Messiah of Israel, but I'm also the priest after the order of Melchizedek. In Psalm 110, you have no right to that whatsoever. And not only so, you shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven. Now when we come to Daniel chapter 7, that's the prophecy concerning the Ancient of Days. Now whether the Lord elaborated upon these things and whether he explained them in detail to them, I would suggest they were such familiar phrases as they are to us, that they would have appreciated that sitting on the right hand of God was that which was promised to the Melchizedek priesthood. And Daniel chapter 7 was very much one of their favourites. Because if Israel was worthy at the time when the Lord would, when their Messiah would come, they believed he would come to them sitting upon the clouds of heaven of Daniel 7. So they knew the Ancient of Days prophecy. There is no doubt about that. And so in verse 13 of Daniel 7, I saw in the night visions, and one, behold, one like the Son of Man, come with clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And we could go on. And the Lord was obviously quoting and using the Ancient of Days prophecy of Daniel chapter 7 to demonstrate that not only was the Son of God, but because he was the Son of God, the Messiah, he would ascend to heaven to sit on the right hand of the majesty of the throne on high, but he would also descend in power and glory upon the clouds of heaven to establish the kingdom to Israel. And the whole of the purpose of the Lord Jesus Christ is there in verse 64 of Matthew chapter 26. That he was the Messiah of Israel, who would ascend to the right hand of the Father, but would come again in great power and glory to establish the kingdom upon the earth. And the high priest rent his clothes. Now again, I wasn't appreciative of this until I started looking at the aspect of rending the clothes. We appreciate that when somebody was in mourning or shock or disgusted about something, they would rend their clothes. What I didn't realise, I'm sure perhaps you did, it was forbidden of the high priest to do that. The high priest could not rend his clothes. Leviticus 21 tells us that. Leviticus 21 verse 10. He that is high priest among his brethren, upon whose head the anointing oil was poured, and that is consecrated upon the garment, shall not uncover his head, nor rend his clothes. And so, Leviticus 21 verse 10, the high priest of Israel could not rend his clothes, but this one does. Caiaphas rends his clothes. I think that's a very appropriate symbol, that the priesthood was of the Levitical order was going to be rent in two. And so incensed was Caiaphas that he says, he has spoken blasphemy. We have now heard this blasphemy from his own mouth. And so he said to the few of the Sanhedrin assembled, what think ye? And they said, he is guilty of death. Can we just go to Mark's account in Mark chapter 14? This is the confirmation that the Lord doesn't duck the question. The end of verse 61 is what they accused him of. Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Notice the slight difference to what we have in Matthew. Art thou the Messiah, the Son of the living God? And Jesus says, I am, and you shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. And it was that which caused the high priest to rend his clothes and for them to condemn him and commit him that he was guilty of death. Notice then verse 65. Here in the presence of the high priest of Israel, some began to spit on him, and to cover his face, and to buffet him, and to say unto him, prophesy. And the servants did strike him with the palms of their hands. So in the presence of the high priest of Israel, he was humiliated in this way. Again, we know the quotations, but so that we can just pull them together to remind ourselves of the humiliation which the Lord had to endure, can we go to Luke's Gospel first of all? Luke chapter 18. The Lord had anticipated, because of what he knew of the Old Testament scriptures, that this is precisely what would happen. But notice what he says in Luke chapter 18, Verse 31, behold, we go to Jerusalem, and all things that are written by the prophets concerning the Son of Man shall be accomplished. And he shall be delivered unto the Gentiles, and shall be mocked and spitefully entreated, and spitted on. And they shall scourge him and put him to death, and the third day he shall rise again. And that was going to happen again under the Roman authorities. But this time, it wasn't the Gentiles who were administering such treatment, it was the Jews. They spat on him. They buffeted him. Again, let's just go back to the prophet Isaiah, and we won't go to all the cross-references. Isaiah chapter 50, as we know, is the one I'm sure you've got linked in your margin to this incident. Verse 5, the Lord God hath opened mine ear. I was not rebellious, neither turned away back. I gave my back to the smiters, and my cheeks to them that plucked off the hair. I hid not my face from the shame and spitting. And so they literally pulled his beard out. You know, the pain and the agony and the humiliation of being spat at, being buffeted, being beaten. It was totally and utterly degrading. When we go over to Isaiah 52, verse 14, as many were astonished at thee, his visage was so marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. Verse 4 of Isaiah 53. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God and afflicted. He was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities, and the chastisement of our peace was upon him. With his stripes we are healed. He was oppressed, verse 7, and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought before as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. And it was the Apostle Peter, many years later, in those wonderful words of 1 Peter chapter 2, which we sometimes read on the Sunday morning, when in verse 21 of 1 Peter 2, for even hereunto were you called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. And so we can imagine the thoughts going through the mind of the Lord as he suffered this beating and this bruising and this humiliation, the degradation of all things that he suffered at the hands of those he had come to try to save, his own fellow countrymen, the chief priest of Israel, the high priest of Israel, and his accomplice, were the ones who administered this awful thing to the Lord at this particular time. He hadn't slept, as we have said, for many a long hour. It was very late in the night, as we would say. It was coming towards the daybreak when all these things were going on. When we come back to Matthew chapter 27, and it's now in verse 1, that when the morning was come, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. If you compare that with Mark chapter 15 and 1, you will notice that Mark adds a bit more to it. Mark 15, verse 1, and straightway in the morning the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council, and bound Jesus and carried him away and delivered him to Pilate. And again, just one more, just have a look at Luke 22. Luke 22, verse 66, and as soon as it was day, the elders of the people and the chief priests and the scribes came together and led him unto their council, saying, Art thou the Christ? And he repeats the very things which they had accused him of before Caiaphas. And so it was necessary that the Sanhedrin council had been brought together, so that after Caiaphas had got what he believed was the necessary charge against the Lord, it was to be ratified at the very break of the day by the Sanhedrin council. So they've been taken, I've brought the plan of Jerusalem, but they were now taking the Lord from the palace of the high priest, dragging him no doubt through the streets of the city to the temple area where the Sanhedrin met in council. And when you think it was the feast day, it was the time of Caiaphas had got what he believed was the necessary charge against the Lord, it was to be ratified at the very break of the day by the Sanhedrin council. So they've been taken, I've brought the plan of Jerusalem, but they were now taking the Lord from the palace of the high priest, dragging him no doubt through the streets of the city to the temple area where the Sanhedrin met in council. And when you think it was the feast day, it was the time of Passover, and they got all these 71 men together, or at least the greatest majority of them, so early in the morning to witness and confirm the death of the Messiah of Israel. It must have been an incredible thing. I'm sure nobody had ever seen these great men, so they thought they were, so early in the morning coming to hold council. As we said last time, it was all totally illegal. Everything which happened here during the trial was against their own laws and their own principles. And so the high priest got what he wanted, confirmation of the council that the Lord should be bound and condemned to death unto Pontius Pilate. When we come back to Matthew chapter 27, I would suggest the incident with Judas happened when they were taking the Lord from the temple area where the Sanhedrin had met up to the fortress of Antonio, where Pontius Pilate resided at the times of feast days and other important times. Now you could, because there were steps going up from the temple area to the fortress of Antonio, it would seem that they had taken him from the place where the council met, and they were taking him across the temple precinct, and it was there that Judas intervened. Because you'll notice in verse 5, he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself. And I would say, as they were dragging the Lord from the council of the Sanhedrin to Pilate, to the fortress of Antonio, they were going a shortcut across the temple area so they could go to the steps and go straight up into the palace, that it was there that Judas confronted them and said that he repented and wanted to have nothing to do with it. As we saw when we looked at Judas in detail, they couldn't be careless now. They'd got what they wanted. He'd, from his own mouth, condemned himself, so they thought. They'd already got an agreement with Pontius Pilate. It was now just going to be a rubber stamp job. They had any time whatsoever for Judas. It was interesting as we contemplated that time, the contrast between the sin of Judas and the sin of Peter, but Judas went and hanged himself. I don't want to get distracted on Judas, because we've dealt with him before. We now come to the point where the Lord is brought before Pontius Pilate. If we can take up the narrative first of all in Mark's Gospel and Mark 15. Mark 15, verse 1, and straightway in the morning the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and bound Jesus and carried him away. Notice, and carried away. Now, whether they literally had to do that because he was in such an awful state because of the beating and the and all the things which had happened in front of the high priest of Israel, it would seem to indicate that, because if you remember when they eventually led him to the crucifixion, someone had to carry his cross. And it could well be that they dragged the Lord or even had to carry him because he was in such a poor state at this time. It must have been awful to see a man so battered and bruised and perhaps unable to walk for himself. And notice Pilate's question, verse 2. Seeing this man in such an awful state, art thou the King of the Jews? But I'd like to look at the other two gospel records, brothers and sisters, because they add quite a bit to what's going on here. Can we go first of all to Luke chapter 23? Verse 1 of Luke chapter 23 says, the whole multitude of them arose and led him unto Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, we have found this fellow to be perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ a king. And Pilate asked him, saying, art thou the King of the Jews? And he answered and said, thou sayest it. Again, keep your finger there and just go to John's Gospel and see what John has to say about the same incident. And obviously we have to take a balance of all that the Gospels have to say, because some add some things that the others don't. And we find in John chapter 18 and in verse 28, then they led Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment, and it was early. So he'd gone from Caiaphas, he'd gone to the Sanhedrin council, they'd approved him, and now he was being dragged or carried up to the fortress on Antonio, to the place where Pilate was. They themselves would not enter into it, lest they should be defiled, that they might eat the Passover. Yeah, the irony of that, I'm sure, we've thought about many times. Then Pilate went out unto them and said, what accusation bring ye against this man? And Anson said, if he were not a malefactor, we would not have delivered him unto thee. Now, on the basis, like we said, that we believe, because of what Micah and the Psalms had said, this was a prearranged setup. That Pilate was simply there to go through the formalities and condemn him to death on the authority of what the Sanhedrin had said. But he doesn't. And he obviously was there with the Lord, and the others hadn't come in because they might defile themselves with the Passover. And so he goes out to them and says, what accusation bring ye against this man? Why should he ask a question? What mattered it to Pilate whether there was one Jew less because he was going to be condemned to death? If the high priest of Israel had already secretly arranged it all and said, we're going to deliver a man and we want him to condemn to death, and Pilate must have agreed, he wouldn't have been here so early in the morning as we said last time. Micah suggests he took a bribe. Why should he now begin to challenge Either he was going through the motions, brethren and sisters, or, as I would suggest, John chapter 18 is inferring, the people were dumbfounded when he goes out unto them in verse 29 and says, "What accusation you bring you against this man?" And they said, "What are you talking about? You know, we wouldn't have bothered you. We wouldn't have gone to all this trouble unless he was worthy of being condemned. If he was not a malefactor, we would not have brought him unto thee, particularly at this unearthly hour." But that wasn't sufficient for Pilate. Something had caused him, after seeing the Lord, to go out, and I would suggest go more than through the rituals. He was a man who was now troubled. Now, we obviously know that his wife had heard many things. Whether his wife had told him at this stage, I would doubt it, as we shall see. I believe there was something about the Lord himself which Pilate looked upon, and he could not believe that the Lord should be condemned to death. Whether they had discussed things, whether the Lord had communicated with him, we're not told. But something caused Pilate to rethink the situation. Now, what they obviously accused him of, once they got back their sense of reasoning, is what we had in Luke chapter 23. "We found this fellow perverting the nation, forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." That wasn't what Caiaphas had brought before the Sanhedrin council to condemn him to death. What he had said to the council was, he claims to be the Messiah, he says himself that he is the Messiah, he's the one who is spoken of in Psalm 110, Daniel 7. Blasphemy is the charge we're having him on. That's not what they say before Pilate. Everything here is basically of a political nature. They accuse him of being an agitator, perverting the nation. They believe that he was trying to stir up sedition, refusing to give tribute to Caesar, which we know was a total lie because he'd said, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar," and obviously of treason, saying that he himself was Christ a king. So everything was of political nature which they accused on before Pilate, as if, yeah, this was sufficient in himself. They don't bring at this stage the blasphemy charge that he is the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Now, it may well be that they thought it would have to be something political which would obviously convince Pilate that he was a threat to Rome, and that's why he should condemn him to death. Pilate picks up the third of the accusations. Pilate asked him in verse 3, "Art thou the king of the Jews?" If we can come back to John's record now. Pilate says unto them, "Take ye him and judge him according to your law." Now the question about "art thou the king" comes in verse 33. So I would suggest, brethren and sisters, that in response to verse 2 of Luke 23, Pilate says, "Look, you take him, you judge him according to the law." And the Jews said unto him, "It is not lawful for us to put any man to death." Now that was not true. It was unlawful for them to put any man to death without the authority of Rome. But they could, under the authority of Pilate, have taken him and put him to death. It didn't need the Romans to do that. But you'll notice what John's record goes on to say in verse 32. "That the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spake, signifying what death he should die." Now again, brethren and sisters, it seems hardly unlikely that the authorities, the chief priests and the elders and the others who had delivered him to Pilate, could really be bothered by which means he was condemned to death, unless there was a reason for it. Sorry, the way he should be put to death, unless there was a reason for it. I wouldn't suggest it was because of what we have in verse 32. We know that the scriptures had to be fulfilled, and all these events, as we saw from the Psalms earlier, were being manipulated by the angels of heaven to cause everything according to the law and the prophets and the Psalms to be fulfilled. I would suggest that it wasn't the reason that the high priest wanted him condemned and killed by means of crucifixion, which was the Roman way of doing it. I would suggest they wanted the Lord, at the time of Passover, to be seen publicly as being condemned by the authorities, because it was the Roman method of death, and that the shame and all the humiliation of crucifixion, and the very fact that, what have they got to lose? Because if he was the Son of God, he would come down from the cross and save himself. So if there was any doubt in anybody's mind that they still thought, maybe, perhaps, because of the miracles he'd done, because of the things that had happened in the previous few days when he'd rode into Jerusalem and all the rest of it, if there was just the slightest doubt as to whether or not he was the Messiah, and if they thought he was, well, let's put it to the test. Let's hang him up there. Because cursed is everyone who hangeth upon the tree. And let's see whether he will come down and save himself. And I think it was because of the public humiliation, the very public way in which he was going to find his death, that the high priest was so insistent that it was the Romans who would condemn, would carry out the death sentence, because then they could accuse him before the people. Well, prove to us now you're the Messiah. Let's see the evidence for ourselves. And it was then that Pilate in verse 33 goes back to the Lord, and away from the mob and away from the chief priests and the elders, he says to the Lord, "Art thou the King of the Jews?" Jesus says, "Sayest thou this thing of thyself, or did others tell it thee of me?" Somebody put you up to this, Pilate. Have the Jews outside accused me of being the King of the Jews? Is it something which the Romans believe, and you as the appointed governor, is it something you're accusing me of? Or is it somebody who's telling you of these things? And Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Thine own nation and the chief priests have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done?" And there was obviously some amazing in the deportment of the Lord, in the way that he talked to Pilate. This wasn't a common criminal. This wasn't someone he was expecting. This was something which he couldn't really understand. He couldn't get behind. And he couldn't understand why his own nation was so insistent that they'd gone to all these great lengths to condemn him to death. Why do they want to do it? What have you really done? Notice the Lord's answer in verse 36. "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence." So how much Pilate appreciated of verse 36, we don't know. He picked up the fact that the Lord was accepting that there was a kingdom. So if there was a kingdom, there was a king. And so he responds in verse 37 by saying, "Art thou a king then?" And Jesus sayest, yes I am, thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. And so Pilate, in this conversation with the Lord, wanted to understand why it was necessary for the Jews to condemn him to death and go to so much trouble, and he wanted the Lord to explain to him whether or not he was a king. And the Lord responded, yes, I am a king. Now again, let's just move on and not get sidetracked about what is truth in that. At the end of verse 38, when he had said this, he went out again unto the Jews and said unto them, I find no fault at all. He wasn't a threat to Rome. There was obviously something about the conversation and what had gone on between the Lord and Pilate which caused this man to want to release him, and he couldn't see why this trumped-up charge had been made and why the Jews were so insistent that he put him to death. So he goes out with the authority of the governorship that he'd got and said, look, I don't know what you're going on about, I find no fault in him, but look, we have a custom. Let's just pacify you, let's sort of get you to appreciate that it's our custom to release unto you Passover, you know, let's release this man who you say is the king of the Jews. And they all cried again saying, not this man, but Barabbas. And Barabbas was a robber. Again, we'll have to go back to Luke 23 just to get a bit more of the detail which we know well. Verse 4, Pilate comes to them and says, I find no fault in this man. So we've got to put in what we've read in John chapter 18. In John chapter 18, that's right. And they were more the fierce, saying, he stirreth up the people, teaching throughout all Jewry, beginning from Galilee to this place. So when Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked whether he was a man who was a Galilean. Yes, and as soon as he knew that he belonged unto Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself also was at Jerusalem at this time. So there was no question that Pilate not only sought to release the Lord, as soon as he realized by the accusation would come back that he was under the jurisdiction of Galilee, he wanted to get rid of the problem. He didn't want to pass any judgment against this man. He had no cause whatsoever to condemn him to death. And so Pilate delivers him to Herod. The not guilty verdict was given to the Jews. But when they came back with another accusation, again, it wasn't the accusation which they were going to condemn him to death for. They don't say that again he claims to be the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Notice, he stirreth up the people. He's a great troublemaker. He's the one who's causing all the problems. And Pilate says, look, I want nothing to do with this. Send him to Herod. So he goes to Herod. And again, we find in verse 8 of Luke 23, Herod was exceeding glad when he saw Jesus, for he was desirous to see him of a long season, because he had heard many things of him and hoped to see some miracle done by him. He questioned him in many words, but the Lord said nothing. And the chief priests and the tribes stood and vehemently accused him, and the Lord says nothing. The Lord does not respond to all their taunts and all their accusations. And what Herod thought. If we go to Acts chapter 4, the Apostle Peter, a bit later on, and that quotation which we said was from Psalm 2, as we know, verse 27, of a truth against the holy child Jesus, whom thou hast anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, with the Gentiles and with the people of Israel, were gathered together for to do whatsoever thy hand and thy counsel determined before to be done. But Herod could find nothing, but nothing, because the Lord didn't answer him a word. He wouldn't demonstrate that he was the Messiah. There was no miracle performed. He didn't hear the gracious words which have normally proceeded from his lips. Herod just saw a beaten and a broken man as far as bodily image was concerned. And Herod determined to make it a bit worse now. Coming back to verse 11 of Luke chapter 23. And Herod, with his men of war, set him at naught and mocked him, and arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him again to Pilate. And the same day, Pilate and Herod were made friends together, for there had been at enmity between themselves. Most authorities suggest that the gorgeous robe here was Herod's own. It was the purple robe which denoted the kingship, which we know Herod was a usurper. But it was the way that Herod was mocking the Son of God and portraying him as the King of the Jews and led him back to Pilate. And I would suggest what we have in verse 12 is that Herod goes himself with Jesus and the mob back to Pilate. And it was then when Pilate and Herod met each other that they became friends again. So the problem hadn't gone away for poor old Pilate. Herod made no comment. He doesn't condemn him. He doesn't say, free him. There's nothing at all recorded about Herod. So Pilate had the problem back in his lap. Can we go to Matthew's Gospel this time, Matthew 27. Matthew chapter 27, and if we can pick it up in verse 13. Then Pilate said unto him, Hearest thou not how many of these things they witness against thee? And he answered him, No, never a word, insomuch that the governor marvelled greatly. Now at that feast, the governor was wont to release unto the people a prisoner whom they would. And they had a notable prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore, when they were gathered together, Pilate said unto them, Will ye that I release unto you Barabbas, or Jesus, which is called Christ? For he knew that for envy they had delivered him. So Pilate saw through their scheming plot. He knew that there was no justifiable reason that this man should be condemned to death. And so he goes to every length whatsoever to make sure that he was going to release the Lord. Or so he thought. Let me just conclude this part by going back to Luke's Gospel, chapter 23. Verse 13, And Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests and the rulers, this is after the Lord's come back from Herod, said unto them, You have brought this man unto me is one that perverteth the people, and behold, I have examined him before you, and have found no fault in this man touching those things whereof you accuse him. No, nor yet Herod, for I sent you to him, and lo, nothing worthy of death is done unto him. I will therefore chastise him and release him. So again, he tries to do everything to pacify these Jews. If a man is not guilty, if a man has done nothing wrong, what right has even the Roman authorities got to chastise him? Their law was just in many respects, and therefore it was only to try and placate the Jews he thought, well, let's beat him up a bit more, and at least that might satisfy you. But even that wasn't going to happen. And so he comes up with the thought that Barabbas is the one who I will put as a choice to the people. Surely they won't want Barabbas, because he goes on to tell us about Barabbas. Of necessity, he must release one unto them at the feast. This was a custom which the Romans did. The reason for it, according to the historians, was because it was Passover, and it was a means of Israel's deliverance from Egypt, when they were slaves in Egypt. The Roman authorities, in order to try and keep the people friendly and keep peace and harmony, so there was no sort of agitation against them, every Passover they released somebody who had been taken into captivity as a symbol to the Jews: you were released from captivity, we're making a gesture of releasing one every year. It was never a choice. It was always the Roman authority who decided who they should release. But this time, he gives them a choice, but he didn't think there was really a choice. Would they want Barabbas? Verse 19. Who for sedition made in the city and for murder was cast into prison. So if there was going to be a choice, okay, they might not like the Lord, and maybe for envy they delivered him, but surely they wouldn't want a murderer released instead of him. And so he said, look, who do you want, Barabbas or Jesus? And I think he had no doubt in his mind that would say, oh, well, okay, beat him up, yeah, but release him. We'll take that as your present for the feast. Release unto us Barabbas. I want to leave it there, because we're going to find now that Pilate does everything he possibly can to release the Lord. But he fails, as we know. And again, I think it's very interesting as to look at some of the inferences as to why Pilate didn't just insist upon it. Anyway, we'll pick up that thought next time, and then we'll proceed to the fact, obviously, that he's led away to be crucified.